You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from Slate, Mark Joseph Stern, in the census case at the Supreme Court, and then Rachel Cohen and Marsha Brown, in the American Prospect, on how Democrats can end run a conservative court. Meanwhile, a gang of four, or is it eight, unveil a $900 billion stimulus. This as millions face loss of paid leave, unemployment insurance, eviction protection. Meanwhile, COVID threatening to overrun California hospitals, and New York State calls health workers back from retirement. Trump has raised $170 million, all since Election Day, in one of the greatest scams in U.S. history, if not the greatest scam. CDC now says that COVID was in the U.S. as early as last mid-December. Trump's attempt at a super broad Flynn pardon may have missed the mark. And Atlas shrugs, and then he skulks away. Trump's dangerous COVID advisor quits in disgrace. Meanwhile, Ohio Republicans are trying to impeach Republican Governor Mike DeWine over his COVID rules. Ajit Pai, the net neutrality killer, to step down from the FCC on January 20th. And farm workers sued Trump administration over their wage freeze through 2023. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Emma Viglin is here with me. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you today?
Well, I'm hanging in there. Battling COVID pandemic fatigue.
Negative test for Sam just before the show, giving us a big boost.
There we go. So we're feeling a little bit more secure. I mean, I haven't seen your test, but I mean, it's not. Well, we, of course, just a reminder, we are actually in the same studio, however, separated by a large plastic tarp that runs about 15 feet across. We have our air filters over there, multiple air filters working on that end of the...
And an open window in the winter.
Open window?
Well, not technically winter yet, but...
And a fan and a CO2 measurer so that we can assure that the air circulation in here is as close to being outside as possible. And last I checked, we were very close, somewhere around between 400 and 500. I don't know what that measures, but let's get right to it today. We got a lot of folks. It's pretty busy around these parts. We are, of course, now about 5 weeks, almost maybe to the day, for the special election in Georgia, which is going to, frankly, implicate some of what we're talking about today with our guests, but also fundamentally a whole host of material issues for the American public. If the Democrats are able to pick up two seats in Georgia, uphill battle, no doubt, it's going to allow them to do things like pass additional stimulus through something like reconciliation. It is going to allow them to quickly approve of Joe Biden's cabinet picks. It's going to allow them to theoretically, at least quickly, approve his judicial picks. It is going to have a tremendous bearing on the functionality of our government. I don't think we're going to see with a 50-50 tie and Kamala Harris breaking the votes, incredibly progressive legislation necessarily.
No.
But we will see some basic like functions of government happen, like a stimulus bill, perhaps. We will talk about the stimulus bill that's going to be announced today coming out of the Senate with a gang of four, maybe eight, depending on how you count it. But that is a bipartisan.
Champion, Joe Manchin involved.
Exactly.
Nah, well, yeah, but it's exactly going to be a lot of legislation like what we're seeing. Middle of the road, centrist ideas. But the thing that Georgia could prevent is enabling the ungoverning, which is what the Republican Party has become and wants to do, which is dismantling government, doing away with government. Trump has been a wrecking ball to that. They used to like to do it in more behind-the-scenes ways. Trump's doing it front and center, but it's key to ensuring that the government at least functions slowly, smallly for people in this country.
Bare minimum. However, it appears that Donald Trump is inhibiting the Republican efforts to win these two seats in Georgia. I still think it's a bit of a long shot, but it's certainly one that becomes a shorter shot every day with Donald Trump doing stuff like this. Here is Donald Trump tweeting out, attacking Brian Kemp. Yesterday, I heard, put this up on the screen. Yesterday, here it is. Do something, Brian Kemp. You allowed your state to be scammed. We must check signatures and count signed envelopes against ballots. Then call off election. It won't be needed. We all win. I'm not quite sure I understand any of this, but I guess what he's saying is that if Brian Kemp follows his prescription, then all the two Senate races will already have been resolved for the Republicans. But you see the problem here, because he is telling the Georgian people, and we did it, we played a clip from Rona McDaniel yesterday, the GOP chair of the Republican National Party, where people in our audience were saying it's all fixed, doesn't matter if we vote. So
And also you're trying to Trump is trying to make the case that Brian Kemp isn't sufficiently on the Republican side in terms of voting and vote rigging, basically.
Right. And
he was an extremist back when he was running against
Abrams
and continues to be.
But his argument is not just that he's not rigging the vote for Trump. He's arguing that he has rigged the vote for Joe Biden and the Democrats. And in which case, if you're a Republican voter, why would you go to the polls? What a waste.
Stay home. I mean, the governor is clearly in the pocket of George Soros, of Hugo Chavez, of the Babadook. All of these people are working with Brian Kemp and Joe Biden to ensure that Republicans never gain power again. Stay home. Stay safe.
That's Trump's message. And here is Kayleigh McEnany. And she's on Fox and Friends this morning. Now, here's the tricky part. This is the sort of fun parlor game that people play. Is Kayleigh McEnany going on the show as the White House spokesperson, or is she going on as the campaign spokesperson? Well, we don't know what hat she's wearing until she gets there.
And Kayleigh McEnany, she's the White House press secretary. It looks like she's on the North Lawn. Kayleigh, good morning to you.
Great to join you.
Good to have you. Okay, so Griff was just talking about the situation down in Georgia where they've got the twin runoff races first week in January. And he brought up, the president is talking about how the election was rigged. And there are a number of Republicans who are worried that that kind of thing could backfire on that particular runoff election, because they say, you know, if it's rigged, if the 2020 November election was rigged and this one's rigged, why should I even bother voting?
Yeah, you know, I'll leave it to the campaign to pontificate on the president's strategy with regards to
the campaign, so you know the thinking there.
I do. I'm joining you in my official capacity today from the White House lawn, but I'll say this. The president has been unapologetic.
Pause it for one second.
Okay, pause it. I'm sorry. I got to get used to saying pause it. First of all, Trump does campaign events and did campaign events from the White House lawn regularly. So that does not preclude the capacity that she would be in. And really what it is she puts on the white hat. She's for the White House. If she puts on the red MAGA hat, she's a part of the campaign, and she'll switch them on and off on cable news based on the questions that she's facing and the ones she doesn't want to answer. So there, that was a way to deflect.
I have an alternate theory.
Go on.
I have an alternate theory. It is that on the White House lawn, if she is next to one of the hedges, she is with the campaign. If she is on the other side of the hedges, she is with the White House. And so that way she can do multiple hits.
Yeah, right.
She takes one step over here and she does that. And then she takes a step over here and she does that. Continue.
For the last 10 months, in saying that mail-in voting, mass mail-in voting is subject to fraud, this has been a key part of what he's talked about when it comes to election integrity. He wants to make sure signatures are matched.
Right.
The mail-in voting is sacrosanct and is treated with the integrity that every American vote deserves, that it's actually encapsulating the vote of the American people.
But yeah, that was just a word salad at the end there.
Right.
She got thrown off by, you know, which hat she was wearing. But I think this could be a problem for the Republicans in Georgia. And frankly, I would not have a big issue with that. You reap what you sow. But first, we will get to Mark Joseph Stern in just a moment. First, a word from our sponsor. This, of course, is the season where people start to look to give to some charities. And for over 10 years, GiveWell.org has helped people who are looking to give find the charities and projects that save and improve lives most per dollar. Here's how they do it. GiveWell dedicates over 20,000 hours a year researching charitable organizations and handpicks a few of the highest impact evidence-backed charities that are out there. All of their research is publicly available. You can look at it for free on their website. And since 2010, GiveWell has helped over 50,000 donors direct over $500 million to the most effective charities. GiveWell never takes any fees, so all of your tax-deductible donations are given to the charity you choose. For me, that's how I found GiveDirectly, and particularly during the course of COVID, but there's been many, many other studies. If you give people in need money directly, they know how best to spend it in a most effective way for them. I mean, literally, our poverty rate went down when we had the stimulus. And in an absence of that, Give Directly is what I do. People, they have a dozen other, I mean, they have many other charities that they've highlighted over there at GiveWell. You can check it out. But that's how I found Give Directly. I don't think it's related necessarily, those two. It just happens to be Give. And they actually are doing COVID relief for some folks in this country as well. You only have a few days left to make a tax-deductible donation before the new year. Go right now, and when you make your first donation to GiveWell, your gift will be matched up to $250. Just go to givewell.org/majority, pick podcast and majority report at checkout. So you pick podcast and majority report at checkout. This matching offer is good for as long as the funds last. Get your first donation matched up to $250 at givewell.org/majority and select podcast and majority report at checkout. Also, I think people know these days, tough to have a fun date night out. Tough always if you have kids to interact with them and get them to do stuff that you're excited for. Which is why we're glad we have Hunt a Killer. In this program, one of us uses it as a way of interacting with his teenage daughter. That'd be me. Another one of us is using it as a date night. Hunt a Killer is a murder mystery game. Feels like an escape room in a box. What happens is they send you deliveries on a monthly basis. If you want, you can also speed it up. And they give you piles of documents. They give you evidence. They give you audio recordings, case files, pictures. You eliminate suspects. You identify murder weapons until you crack the case and you catch the killer. You'll learn about the backstory of each of the suspects. In fact, in this case that we have, it's a good opportunity for me to teach my daughter about history a little bit, you know, in this country. And like I say, if you can't wait for the next box, they'll send it to you quickly. Matt, how is date night going with, and you're on the same case, right? The theater?
The Cadence Theater. Yeah. I just got my second box. Now
I actually am really enjoying it in a kind of childish kind of way. Like, the documents they give you are very authentic looking, so you really feel like you're some kind of detective. I'm getting a kick out of it.
I love that. Like, they look kind of old and
they do a good job of it.
Right. Yeah.
They do a good job of it. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to hunttokiller.com/majority. Use promo code majority at checkout. You get 20% off your first box. Head to hunttokiller.com/majority for 20% off. Show your support for our show and have some fun. That's hunttokiller.com/majority. And lastly, this episode, and frankly, my breakfast, as I'm looking at that box right there, brought to you today by Magic Spoon. So you remember, breakfast cereal, one of the best things about being a kid. Sit down, you get all that sugary goodness, then you drink up the milk, and maybe it's a different color because you got your fruity or you got your chocolate. Of course, you can't eat that as an adult because it's full of sugar and junk. Well, fortunately, there is a way to relive that magic of your childhood cereal in a healthier way. Magic Spoon is a cereal company that's discovered a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals with 0 grams of sugar, 11 grams of protein, and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. And so many of you have asked, apparently now you can finally build your very own custom variety box. It comes in a box, a shipment of 4. You can choose from best-selling cocoa, fruity, that's Saul's favorite, frosted, blueberry, plus brand new flavors, including peanut butter and cinnamon. Now, I don't know if this makes me a bad parent, but I bring the cinnamon here in the office.
I had some the other day.
It's good, right? And I just, Saul's happy with his fruity, but I'm not giving up the cinnamon. There's just no way. I will let them have the peanut butter. I'll let them try that one too. But the cinnamon is all for me. I know that's not, you probably shouldn't brag about that when you're doing that to your kids, but what are you going to do? It's keto friendly. It's gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. Go to magicspoon.com/majority report. You can build your own custom variety box and give it a try today. If you use our code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout, you will get free shipping. Magic Spoon's so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they're going to give you your money back. No questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code majority report for free shipping. We thank Magic Spoon for their sponsoring of this show. And frankly, also for me having a healthy breakfast. Same with my kids. All right. Let's welcome to the show. Do we have them? Mark Joseph Stern from Slate. Do we have him?
He's joining now.
He's joining now. Things have changed on the Supreme Court, I think, since we spoke last. Amy Coney Barrett, of course, is now a member. I think last time we spoke to Mark, she was just about to ascend to that position.
Ascend.
As it were.
Yes.
Do we have him?
He's in, but I'm not seeing his video or audio, unfortunately. Let's see here.
All right. We're just going to take give it a second. Bear with us, folks. Brendan, I have stopped the clock.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that...
All right. Well, we're working on Mark as we speak. The case that, of course, in front of Supreme Court over the past couple of days was the question as to whether the Trump administration can essentially come up with 2 different counts from the census. One count would be all the people in the United States at the time of the census,
it should be the point of the census.
Well, it is the constitutional mandate of the census, not how many citizens are in the country, how many people are in the country.
And
and this number is used to create apportionment for congressional seats. And what the Trump administration wants to do is to provide a second number, And that is a number of people who live within a district, let's say, minus some number that they have calculated of those people who are undocumented immigrants. And I think we have Mark now. No, we do not. And this issue was argued in front of the Supreme Court over the past couple of days. And in many respects, the issue itself as to whether one could do that, whether that's constitutional, was a second order question. The first order question was, is the case ripe at this time? Is there standing for those who are suing the Trump administration and trying to prevent them from breaking down these numbers in this way and using the non-actual number of people in the district number as a way of deciding this apportionment? Now, these census figures are not just about the question of congressional seats, but also in terms of resources that districts have. And I think we have them now. Mark Stern from Slate, welcome to the program.
Hi, sorry about the technical difficulties.
No worries. That is the age of COVID. So I was just giving a breakdown of the case, Trump versus New York, which is about the Trump administration's attempt to essentially create two different numbers from the census for the purposes of creating congressional districts. Why don't you take it from there, just to make sure that I've articulated it at least close.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The Trump administration is trying something that's never been done before in the history of the republic, which is to create a set of census figures that excludes undocumented immigrants. And the plan is to use those figures when dividing up seats in the House of Representatives. So every 10 years after every census, there's a new apportionment of seats in the House. This year, it looks like Florida will gain a seat, New York will lose a seat. It matches population, right? Trump wants to exclude undocumented immigrants from that count. So states like California that have large immigrant communities, they could lose up to three seats in the House of Representatives, and by extension, three votes in the Electoral College, because that's how those votes are calculated. So the goal here is to shift representation away from immigrant-heavy blue states like California toward rural, whiter, more Republican states.
How does the Trump administration intend to calculate how many undocumented immigrants are in a district?
So it's a great question because, as you may remember, the Supreme Court blocked the citizenship question that was set to appear on the census. So there's no official count of immigrants, let alone undocumented immigrants in the United States, let alone in each state. So what the Trump administration is trying to do is use both state data and administrative records to match census responses to individuals that they suspect to be undocumented. It's super slapdash and slipshod. It is an untested method. And the administration has already admitted it's taking much longer than they expected. They're having a lot of trouble with it, they've said in court, because this is not a really reliable way to calculate these figures. The truth is they're probably going to end up taking a big guess and then trying to back up that guess with some scaffolding that's all BS.
Okay, so if I'm a Supreme Court justice, I'm looking at that with a certain amount of skepticism in terms of like, can you even effectively give me a number? Are you just making this up? I mean, because what's to stop you from just saying like, oh yeah, no, all of them seem to be in California and New York and nowhere else. A, that's the first, well, I don't know if that's the first order problem. It seems to me the first order problem is just like the question of itself is like the census is a constitutionally mandated exercise. And for these textualists and originalists, it says very in very clear language that the census is supposed to count the people in the United States, not the citizens, just who is in the country at the time. And the census is supposed to be the basis for these congressional districts.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that practice goes back to 1790, when a lot of the guys who actually wrote the Constitution also helped to conduct the first census and sent U.S. Marshals out to do it and said, count everyone, not just citizens. One way to think about this case is that the original formula here, of course, counted enslaved people as three-fifths of a person, right? That was the notorious three-fifths clause. Trump's plan is to count undocumented immigrants as zero-fifths of a person, to say that they aren't persons at all. So not just restoring the three-fifths clause, but in some ways making it more egregious. And I think the originalists and the textualists have to look at that and look at the 14th Amendment, which undid the three-fifths clause and says, no, we have to count every person equally. You look at those words, the constitutional text, the historical practice here, and there is just no way to get to what Trump wants to do. What he is trying here goes against the Constitution, and you really have to adopt a pretty loose understanding of the English language to even argue that Trump is doing something legal.
So, I mean, how does this case even get in front of the Supreme Court? And then we'll get to the question of, I guess, standing and ripeness that in some ways seems to be, well, I'll let you characterize what that's about. But how does this case even get to the Supreme Court? It seems to be like one of those things where, If I was in charge of granting certification for this case, I would have just said, like, are you kidding me?
Well, a lot of us, myself included, were hoping for that. Specifically, we were hoping that the court would just say, without holding arguments, yes, this is unconstitutional, which is a power that the court has. And it has done so in other cases involving, say, campaign finance regulations. But here, the court apparently could not come to an agreement behind the scenes. And so it decided to hold oral arguments and treat this kind of like a normal case. It had expedited briefing. And that made me worried. It made a lot of us worried that the justices might go along with what Trump wanted. Thankfully, I no longer think that's necessarily true. It seems like the conservative justices are skeptical that what Trump's trying to do here is unconstitutional. They seem to think this is, you know, this goes against all history and all constitutional text. But they are also looking, I think, for a way out of this case, a way to avoid deciding this case on the merits. And during oral arguments yesterday, we heard a lot of talk about ways to just duck this, to punt it, to kick the can down the road, and to hope that Joe Biden comes into office and just sort of takes this case off the Supreme Court's plate.
Okay. And now I understand why, like the mechanism in which they're going to punt this is by saying, hey, there's two concepts, I guess, that Kavanaugh was sort of expressing during the oral arguments. One is, you are talking about a hypothetical harm because you don't know what the number the Trump administration is going to come up with as to how many undocumented immigrants are in the country. So you can't really tell if it's actually going to change anything in terms of apportionment at this point. So you're talking about a hypothetical harm. You need to come back. This is a concept. You need to come back to the court when there's an actual harm. And I guess more or less on the same level as the concept of ripeness, that there, nothing has happened enough to get to that point where you can even assess the harm. And so that's how they would punt it. But why would they punt it as opposed to just sort of saying like, yeah, this isn't going to happen. Like, are they thinking down the road, there may be some other doctrines that we may loosen in some way that would allow something like this to happen? I mean, what's behind that?
Yeah. So my fear is that the conservative justices, specifically Kavanaugh and Alito, were on this trail that you just described. They seem to be looking for a way to signal that, hey, the Trump administration can't do this, you know, not a categorical exclusion of undocumented immigrants, but it could find a subset of undocumented immigrants and exclude those instead. And so there's two consequences to that. Number one, they suggested maybe that's legal. And number two, they suggested maybe it's a small enough number that, as you said, no state's actually going to lose any seats in the House. So the case doesn't really matter. Nobody even has standing here. I think both of those are really dishonest ways of looking at this case. I mean, first of all, if you take everyone in ICE detention right now and exclude them, which is something that Trump is apparently considering, that is still a lot of people who are persons who reside in the United States. I mean, 57% of people who are detained by ICE today will be released back into the country at some point in the future. To say those people don't count, that is still really bad and unconstitutional. But number two, this idea that it's, you know, nobody has standing to challenge the case if an apportionment seat isn't lost or gained or whatever, you know, that's a harm, but it's not the only harm going on here. You also have Trump defying 200 plus years of historical practice, meddling with this census power that's supposed to be Congress's authority here, and messing up the numbers that states are going to receive when they start drawing their own district lines. This has such ripple effects over the next few months and over the next 10 years, really, that for the court to kick the can down the road, I think there's no way for them to do that without creating a mess in the process.
And we should also say, in the case of the ICE detentions, I mean, aside from sort of it being repugnant to say they're not people, if you have an ICE detention facility, that is going to implicate what you need in terms of resources in that district. And presumably some of that money is coming from the feds, and that's going to affect, like, you know, I don't know, what if there's a federal emergency and you're going to have all those people
due process for those in detention? I mean, can't just strip them of their representation in Congress because they're in the detention facility.
Right. I mean, there's a whole host of issues, right? Centered around that one. And in the other instance, couldn't there also be an argument that you are affecting the actual functioning of the census by even raising this possibility where we're going to use the data that we get from the census to isolate individuals in a certain district? I mean, that seems contrary to what the court has held in the past in terms of, like, census takers and the idea that we're trying to count everybody and nothing should interfere with that process.
Right, exactly. And so that's one of two ways to look at the harms here. And I think there's a real divide on the court, because I totally agree with you. Simply beginning this process of cordoning off a certain group of people and telling them you're not represented, you don't count, that seems to be really problematic and something that the court should stop. But the conservative justices were suggesting, well, we're not going to get involved with that because that's just the government doing its thing. You know, if Wilbur Ross sends Donald Trump a piece of paper that has these calculations that exclude these immigrants, that's not our problem. It only becomes our problem when the seats are explicitly apportioned between the states. And that just seems dangerously wrong to me, because at that point, and even Chief Justice Roberts said this, but he's not as important anymore. He said, you know, how do you unscramble the eggs? Once this data is out there in the world, and once Trump has it and he's transmitting it to Congress, how do the courts unscramble the eggs? It seems like the damage is kind of already being done. But again, you saw Kavanaugh and Alito saying, no, 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 let's just hold off, wait and see, and we'll deal with it afterwards.
So when does the court rule on this? Because this seems like something, if you're going to enjoin them, right? I mean, that's what the plaintiffs seek to do, is enjoin this sort of can of worms being opened, because you can't shove the genie back into the can of worms, I guess, to the metaphors. When do they rule on this?
Yeah, so, you know, they don't have a deadline, but there are a few good deadlines for the government that I think the court is aware of. So in theory, Trump is supposed to get this data on December 31st, but the government's already said they're not going to be able to meet that deadline. That's a big problem, because Congress is supposed to take a look at this data by January 10th and begin the apportionment process no later than that. And yet we have the Census Bureau now saying that it won't have the information ready until January 26th. Which, as you may recall, will be when Trump is no longer president. So I think there is a chance that the Supreme Court sits on this case and watches what happens, watches the Trump administration blow past each of these deadlines, and then just, if they can, hold out until Joe Biden takes office. Joe Biden will come in and do something to try to undo all of this mess, and then the court will say, we can't deal with this case anymore because everything has changed. We're sending it back down to the lower courts.
What a weird way to approach this, rather than just refusing to take the case in the first place. If that's what they do, if they basically just wait until the case goes stale, essentially, when Biden comes in.
They're being political, and they are, they pretend to be apolitical.
Why would they? Why take that tack? Just because they there's something that they want to have another bite at in the future?
Well, so the court has actually mandatory jurisdiction over these cases, which means that it cannot simply ignore them. It has to do something with these cases because they're challenging apportionment and redistricting. There's this special rule. Now, that doesn't mean that the court has to take the case and hear arguments and issue a decision on the merits. It just means that the court has to do something to deal with the case, right? And so, I think that what the court obviously should have done is simply upheld the lower court's injunctions and said, okay, look, the lower courts have enjoined this. It's obviously unconstitutional, so we're never going to scramble the eggs in the first place. But instead, they took it up. They held it on an expedited schedule, which is something the court rarely does, gave the government everything it asked for in this scheduling, said, okay, we'll rush all of this. And then the government comes into the court and says, we actually have no idea when any of this is going to happen. So very messy.
Mark Joseph Stern, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much, Sam.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Rachel Cohen and Marsha Brown from the American Prospect working with The Intercept on how Democrats can deal with this conservative court. We'll be right back in just a moment. Okay, we're back. Joining us from the American Prospect and also, I think, from The Intercept, Rachel Cohen, Marsha Brown. Welcome to you both. You guys have written an incredible a piece in The Prospect with the help of The Intercept on that question of how Democrats can deal with a court that seems to be hostile to just about everything that I think a lot of Americans take for granted that the government can do and take for granted in terms of like laws that have already been passed. Rachel, let's start with you. You cite the example of Lilly Ledbetter. Just quickly tell us that story so that we get a sense of the concept here.
Yeah, so Lilly Ledbetter, and thank you for having us. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which maybe people listening to the show might remember, was
Barack Obama. We're having problems with your internet for some reason. I think we're having trouble with connection. Marsha, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Let's Marsha, why don't you answer that question for us and we can see what's going on with
I'll try switching to my phone and you can go.
Okay.
Sure. So yeah, thank you very much for having us. So the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which passed in 2009, was the first piece of legislation that President Obama signed. And it was actually a response to a Supreme Court decision, which Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote in her dissent was very parsimonious and was really kind of nitpicky. And in her dissent, she said, the ball is in Congress's court. And so she actually called on Congress to clarify the language in the statute, because effectively the court had said that, okay, yeah, there might be some pay discrimination here, but your statute of limitations has expired because the clock began counting when you were hired, not when you first realized you were experiencing pay discrimination. And so Congress updated the statute of limitations, and that was all it took for that to essentially nullify that Supreme Court decision.
Okay, and you guys have outlined a whole multiple silos, essentially, where there are some key rulings that Congress could overturn. Part of this is really incumbent upon what happens in Georgia, although you do cite a couple of places where you have you have bipartisan, I guess, opportunities. And Rachel, why don't we start with you on that? What are those bipartisan opportunities? Where, what areas and what specific laws do you think that we can look to a perhaps a gang of four again or a gang of eight dealing with Supreme Court rulings?
I can answer it, and then I'm actually going to let Marcia speak a little more specifically to antitrust, because that is one of the areas and she wrote about that specifically. But I think you're right. Obviously, our judicial overrides will be easier if Democrats reclaim the Senate. And we think that this is something that, the party should be making more clear to voters in terms of laying out what's at stake. It's not just Supreme Court nominations. It's actually the ability to override bad Supreme Court rulings, too, in this upcoming runoff. But we do also think that even if they don't win, there is still opportunity to overturn bad decisions, and there are different legislative ways people get individual things through. But historically, there have been judicial overrides, bipartisan judicial overrides in civil rights. In 2008, there were a bunch of overrides passed to the Americans with Disabilities Act. So that was bipartisan. We have had times in the past where voting rights and civil rights were more bipartisan. And we think antitrust is another area that could be a possible area for compromise. Marcia might want to speak more to that, though.
Yeah, Marcia, tell us about antitrust, because I have to say that I am a little skeptical about the prospect of a bipartisanship. 2008, in human terms, was not that long ago. In terms of where the parties, particularly the Republican Party, has gone, it seems like a half a century ago. But tell us about antitrust.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, in 2009, Democrats had the House and the Senate, so it was a different time. But I think what is important to think about with antitrust is that there's the Democratic majority in the House Subcommittee on Antitrust came out with a 400-page report where they actually identified, I think, over half a dozen Supreme Court cases that would be important to overturn to strengthen antitrust law. And Ken Buck, a Republican on the committee, released a response called The Third Way. I think he called it The Third Way. For reform, where he actually identified some areas where he thought there would be some bipartisan agreement. One of those cases was Ohio versus Amex, where there might be some room, American Express, where there might be some room for collaboration on that. And just to add to what Rachel was saying, these overrides can be passed as legislative riders, so you can attach them to sort of unrelated bills in the House and the Senate. So there are ways to do it without passing it as comprehensive legislation, but a number of the overrides that we've identified are actually included in several current pieces of legislation that are more comprehensive that have already passed the House, and some that haven't passed but have been proposed. So there are different ways to pass them, but like legislation, you do need to have some excitement, some push behind it.
I want to get to some of the other silos, but and I don't know which one of you knows the history best about this, but why do you think this changed? I mean, you write that during the 70s and the 80s, even into the mid 90s, Congress would, and we should say, up until that time, the House was dominated by Democrats. I mean, and so there was never any question of the Democrats not controlling the House at that time. Occasionally, you would get the Senate. What changed in terms of the disposition of legislatures and their relationship to the court?
Yeah, well, we a lot. So there are legal scholars who have been sort of trying to figure this out. And we talk about some factors. There's not like one clear answer, but it's sort of a number of things were going on. So some legal scholars say it's just that Congress got more partisan, more polarized. And I think people agree that's obviously played one factor, but it doesn't really explain everything, because Congress is pretty partisan and polarized in the 90s when they still passed a bunch of judicial overrides. So, and another factor people cite is that the, you know, the decline in overrides also, you know, there has been a decline in congressional staff. So when you have less capacity in Congress on committees to be doing this kind of research, a lot of Congress members just sort of outsource things to outside advocacy groups now. You know, as they lost their own internal capacity, that could have been a factor. But, you know, we also make an argument about Democrats specifically, which is just like there has been a mindset. There has been sort of a relative inertia about treating Supreme Court cases as like the end of the road, the final step there. Like, and we see that in just the way the reaction to our piece has sort of showed this. Like most people, this hasn't been a way of thinking about bad decisions. It has on the right, and conservatives like often talk about this, but on the progressive liberal side, you know, if the Supreme Court weighs in, the response from a lot of liberal lawmakers and progressive advocacy groups has been to sort of be really upset and frustrated, but not talk about, well, how can we now mobilize and organize a law to override it? And so we're sort of making the case that this tool was used by Democrats for decades, and it has, and we can use it again. And for some, you know, we need to get back in the mindset of recognizing that this is a legal and important way that to represent the separation of powers and for Congress to exert its, you know, legal authority. So we're sort of trying, I don't know exactly why they dropped that mindset, but they did. And so we're sort of trying to say, like, we need to pick that back up again.
It seems like it's consistent with a general lack of, exertion of will by Democrats that we have seen. There is a temerity that has existed since that era. And frankly, we have the leadership we still have today in the Democratic Party. They all came in during that era. Right. And when this, so I suspect that that's not a coincidence. Let's talk about reproductive rights, Marcia. What is your sense of what the court can do there? And like I say, the folks should really check out the piece, because there's you have a whole slew of these silos of law which they can be changed. But let's just start with reproductive rights. What can the court do to strengthen reproductive rights in this country? The Congress can do.
I actually, Rachel wrote about reproductive rights, so I'd want to pass the microphone to her for that.
All right, Rachel, yeah, tell us, please.
Sure. You know, and one thing that I say in the piece about reproductive rights is there's a lot of political momentum that if Democrats reclaim power, what they really have been talking about for a long time is overturning the Hyde Amendment, which is the law that bans any federal funding going to pay for abortions. And so this is not to detract from that. It's just to, to put out that there is more that a, you know, active, proactive Congress could do. And so one of them, the case that we talk about, you may recall the 2014 Supreme Court case, the Hobby Lobby case. And that centered around a law from 1993 called the religious
RFRA.
RFRA, yeah, RFRA, yes. Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yes.
Yes. And so basically, civil rights groups, advocates, religious freedom groups felt, argued that RFRA was being manipulated and distorted from its original intent in that Hobby Lobby case as a way to deny people from access to contraceptive services. And what Congress could do to not only address that case, but future attempts to use RFRA in negative ways, because it is also being used to deny non-Christian parents adoption. It's being used to deny transgender patients' rights. Like, it's sort of being used in a host of different ways. And there is a bill in Congress right now called the Do No Harm Act that was introduced last year. And it would basically tweak and clarify the RFRA statute to basically preempt any future lawsuits of that kind if it would prevent harm to a third party. So it's sort of a sweeping way to get at all the different sorts of ways that RFRA could currently be used to deny reproductive healthcare to or other sort of services to people on basis of religious, you know, things.
Marcia, did you work on the environmental law?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about that, because one of the things that I know there's a concern about is that this court in particular is going to deal with things like the Chevron doctrine and the idea of the delegatory power of Congress. In other words, for folks who, and I'm disappointed if my audience isn't fully aware of both those doctrines, but the idea essentially that the courts and Congress can delegate to, let's say, the EPA, you figure out what constitutes clean water and you do the steps that are necessary to make sure that we have clean water. We're just going to say, pass a law, we want clean water. And courts generally would defer also to the EPA. How can they deal with in what you write about in terms of what Congress can do to fix those things? What can Congress do to sort of inoculate some of these protections from a court that is determined to revisit Chevron and this delegation authority that Congress has?
Yeah, I'm really glad you bring that up. The Chevron doctrine is really critical, both when it comes to environmental law, but also in other areas of the law, because it is about deferring to an agency's interpretation of the law. And so where we've seen that in the environment is where the EPA kind of interprets the law kind of expansively to include greenhouse gases as an air pollution, and therefore they can regulate that. And so there have been several cases where this has come up, and there the EPA has said, okay, we're going to regulate emissions because of greenhouse gases because they're considered an air pollution, and then the court will kind of temper that. And I think what's really important to think about when it comes to these to this area of the law, but also to the larger thesis of our piece, is that this is a way for Congress to take back power. And from the court, where we always kind of think of, oh, the liberal activist justices, but actually a lot of conservative justices are pretty activists when it comes to something that might have been considered subtle law, like the Chevron doctrine, that they're now kind of bringing back up and thinking about, like, well, actually, how are we going to reinterpret this? And so there is some worry there. And I think a lot of environmental scholars are also worried that if Congress takes up any kind of comprehensive environmental reform, that it could actually come out more watered down than it is now. So despite the fact that Congress and the agencies are working with statutes, some of which are 40 years old, passed during the Nixon administration, some of them have been updated, but not very many. The EPA has actually been able to kind of stretch those statutes through the Chevron doctrine. So it's going to be really key for the Chevron doctrine to really maintain its strength so that the existing statutes can be used. But some scholars do think that there is areas to tweak around the edges, and even if there isn't comprehensive legislation where, you know, that could open a can of worms, these kind of statutory overrides would be an option for Congress to clarify the language. So the Clean Water Act is a really big one. Actually, what happened with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline this year, that was also one where they could just clarify the statute, and then the pipeline wouldn't have been able to get a permit to cross the Appalachian Trail twice. And there's also ones where different agencies offer different permits, but sometimes the kind of pollution doesn't fall into either of those permits. And so then the corporation will argue, well, we don't really need any kind of permit regulation. We can just do this. Or if we have one, we're fine. And the court kind of says, oh, okay. So there are ways to clarify that and strengthen some of our environmental protections through these overrides.
This may be outside of your portfolio, but is there a way for Congress to protect something like the Chevron doctrine? Is there a way for Congress to protect its ability to delegate authority? Or are these constitutional questions that Congress can't really mend?
That's a good question. I would say that that's probably a little outside of my expertise. I would ask a legal scholar that question. But I would say that, and this is something we bring up in the piece, these statutory overrides are a way for Congress to directly intervene, for a Congress to take back power, to clarify the statute, update the law, which is really a classic thing to do. I mean, the environment changes, the pollution changes, and so Congress needs to update the statute. That's just kind of, that should be considered regular lawmaking. But conservatives have never shied away from, oh, I don't really like this court decision, and so we're going to fight back against this. And the Roe v. Wade 40-year battle has been a great example of that, where it was a constitutional decision. Congress couldn't really act on that, but conservatives could have this grassroots movement where they cut back and tempered that decision. So it would be great for liberals to take up a cause that they think is really important. I think Citizens United is a really great example of this, where it's a constitutional decision. Congress can't overturn the decision or nullify the decision, but Congress can write laws that temper the force of it.
Right. We see conservatives do this, like you say, on the question of choice, where we have states across the country where a woman's ability to have an abortion is effectively gone. And these introductions of these so-called trap laws are also equally problematic. Rachel Cohen, Marsha Brown, the piece is in the American Prospect, How to Counteract the Court. It was done in partnership with The Intercept. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we will wrap it up here and we will be back tomorrow. But there is a theme, Emma, that that we have seen over the past really 30 years close to in Congress. Broadly speaking, regardless of who has controlled Congress or House in particular, there has been a ceding of power to certainly to the presidency and the executive, but also to the courts. And it is really going to be a question to see how aggressive the Democrats are going to be in the House, whether they have the Senate or not. I guess we will have to wait and see.
Well, I mean, they certainly have no choice, in my view. Not that that's ever stopped them from doing the cowardly thing before, but the fact that McConnell and the Republicans have done this naked power grab when it comes to the courts, and not just the Supreme Court, lower courts as well, that means that Democrats do have to be proactive in mitigating some of the harm, because they've already indicated they're going to block Biden's judicial appointments. McConnell has decided the way to cement his legacy and corporate power in this country and wealthy hegemony is by stacking the courts with conservative judges that block all progressive ideas, priorities, and ensure the subjugation of people.
So. All right. Well, we will talk more about this in the coming weeks and months until tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we will be heading into the fun half. Nomi will be joining us, I think, if we get our technical issues resolved. Quite a challenge today. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member. Become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only get the free show, not only get the free show without commercials, but you also get the fun half, where we get extra content. So jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, it's getting to be that season. Now is the time to get your Hanukkah gifts or your Christmas gifts, your Kwanzaa gifts, or
Hanukkah's right around the corner.
Whatever you're going to celebrate.
Yeah.
And the place to do that, of course, is at shop.majorityreportradio.com. We're coming out with new beanies, right, Brendan?
Yeah, I didn't know we were dropping that today, but yeah, they are in the works.
An image of it, but we're gonna do it.
Oh yeah,
but people should check it out right now. Maybe we should drop those babies up on the site, because we only have 24 day shopping days left or whatever.
Right, right.
Whatever the advent calendar is,
you can't buy anything at all after that.
No, that's you're gonna want them. Well, winter starting. Hey, folks, Hunt a Killer is a murder mystery subscription box where you'll sift through piles of documents, evidence, audio recordings, and more. You'll eliminate suspects, you identify murder weapons until you crack the case and catch the killer. Hunt to Killer has over 2,000 five-star reviews. It's no wonder why people love them so much. Go to hunttokiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. Check it out. Nomi. Do we have Nomi?
She's not in yet. No.
All right. Well, in the meantime, check out the Antifada. You can go to patreon.com/theantifada for what Jamie's got cooking this week. Matt?
Yeah, last night on the brand spanking new Left Reckoning YouTube page, and here's the logo. I have it ready this time. There it is. Boom.
Wow. All right, what's going on here? Now, so there's a little bit of, like, obviously, this is a tip of the hat to the fact that you're from North Dakota.
Well, no. In fact, this is a Texas landscape.
Yeah, I was also going to say Griscom is from Texas. Yeah. So, right. I mean, that's the reckoning part, right? It's not just Texas.
I mean, there's the star.
And there's the star from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And what is all Texas?
What is that? What is the banner, like that stuff? That seems reminiscent of something.
Oh, you think so? I don't know. I just think. I couldn't tell you, to be honest. I'm a little bit
disappointed because I thought there was going to be a lot more behind that. I thought there was going to be a link.
It's the banner that Stephen F. Austin. No, I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was. I mean, I liked the logo, but I just thought that there was going to be like some lineage there. Like we borrowed that from the. Okay. All right. Never mind.
No, I mean we kind of loosely were inspired by. Texas area sports logos, I think, is the
wow. Okay,
so yeah, but we did a think tank last night, David and I. We talked about a few things. I can't really remember what. We talked about Neera Tanden quite a bit, so check that out.
It's called Think Tank.
What was that?
App.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Think Tank.
I guess we're going to talk about this with Nomi about Neera Tanden, but there's a there really appears, at least, in the event that Democrats don't win in Georgia, that the Republicans are sort of focusing on Neera Tanden to sink her nomination.
Which is what made the appointment so stupid.
It's also funny to me that they're trying to sink it over her posting, which is like, that's a criticism we do have of her, but that's not really the criticism.
Trump's your president. Trump's your president. You want to make it about posting?
I mean, I think I don't know. I'm curious. We can bandy around the different theories. We still don't have Nomi yet, right?
No, we don't.
Okay. Well, then, folks, 3 p.m. today, check out the Nomi Key Show on YouTube, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. You can I'm not sure who's going to be on her show today, but always, always worth checking out at 3 p.m. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We're going to try and take some phone calls. We're not going to have time for too many, but we'll try and take some. And we'll take your IMs. You can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. Be right back.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.